Retina Rounds, podcast number one. For the first episode in our podcast series, Retina Rounds podcast co-host Stephen Schwartz interviews a true giant in the field of vitreoretinal surgery, Steve Charles. Dr. Charles has been a pioneer in surgical innovation, having developed many of the machines and tools we use every day in the operating room. In this interview, Dr. Charles talks about his path in ophthalmology, shares insights on the early days of developing a modern vitreoretinal surgical platform, and provides valuable clinical pearls for both comprehensive ophthalmologists and retina specialists. The interview is peppered with many interesting anecdotes, which I'm sure you're really going to enjoy. Let's check it out.
Well, welcome everybody to the Retina Rounds podcast. Today, we're lucky to have a true giant in our field, Steve Charles, who has invented, optimized, and discarded more creative ideas in ophthalmology than I would easily say anyone alive today.
Thank you, my friend.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It's an honor to be here.
Thanks, Steve. It's a real honor for us to have you here.
And appreciate it.
I can say that our friendship over these last 35 years has been so meaningful to me.
To me as well.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. So I would like to start off by asking you something a little bit unexpected, which is tell me about your childhood and how you ended up in ophthalmology.
Let's see, like everybody, I'm just fortunate. I had two fantastic grandfathers. One of them I never met, not before I was born. The grandfather that I spent a ton of time with was a mechanical engineer. So it was crystal clear to me I wanted to be an engineer from when I was 3 years old on. I went to his factory every day with him. He ran a huge plant. They built giant diesel engines. So when I went to college, it was clear that engineering school was the plan. I went to three different universities, Miami, where my dad was a professor undergraduate, and my dad was professor and chair of art, and he was a very famous sculptor and painter, and I had no artistic inclination. So then I went to NC State. I was born in Raleigh and went there. But I got the idea of designing drill rigs, so I went to Oklahoma. I just couldn't figure out an application of the engineering that met with my sort of needs to help people, to do good things, and also not to just sit in a little cubicle, you know, with the laptop and with the computer in front of me the rest of my life. And so I that was originally the idea about the oil and gas business. So then all of a sudden it hit me. I said, well, one grandfather was a surgeon. My godfather, my dad's oldest brother, was the most famous colon and rectal surgeon. Why don't I design surgical equipment and be a surgeon? And so I didn't have any money in college, so on Friday mornings, I would go to the library and read and medical journals and just kind of skim through them and try to learn a little bit. And so I decided before I went to med school in hometown in Miami, I literally decided it would be neurosurgery, ENT, or eye. And I lived in the VA. I didn't have any money. And so I went and watched people operate. And the guy I met, Dave Sim, who's an Olympic gold medalist, and he was a third-year Bascom Palmer resident, and he was Olympic gold medalist in 100, 200 meters. Superstar wide receiver, baseball player, and of course track star at Duke, and a Bascom Palmer resident. And he took me under his wing, took me to the OR, and said, you're going to do a cataract on a VA patient, freshman med student. So I put the sutures in, and he took the lens out, and I put the sutures in. And I operated on a bunch of animals in the VA surgical lab. So I started hanging out Bascom Palmer 3 weeks into medical school, and 3 months into medical school, Edward W. D. Norton, who founded Bascom Palmer, gave me an indirect ophthalmoscope. And when the guy that was at the time dean of the med school, founder Bascom Palmer, you know, and such a prominent guy and leader, gives you an indirect, I mean, it's clear that you're going to be around this someday if you can make it. And so at the end of my second year of med school, he called me in his office and he said, I want to plan your summer research so it's meaningful, but I want to talk to you about something else first. And I thought, man, I'm in trouble. And he said, listen, he said, do you want to do a residency here? Yes, sir, Dr. Norton. And he said, do you want to interview at other places? I said, only if you want me to. He said, we had a faculty meeting, you're accepted. So I was accepted to the residency program. I mean, before, even then they had a matching program, but they had a faculty meeting, he said, you're in.
And, well, he had good judgment.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So Norton is, I attribute an awful lot of the opportunity to Norton, and he was just phenomenal.
And when you think back to your mentors, obviously those in your family, but I only got to meet Dr. Norton a few times, and he was so charismatic and magnetic.
And humble.
And that was, he, used to say things like greatness only comes if you're around other great people or supported by great people.
No question.
Big teamwork guy, big standing on the shoulders of giants guy. What did you learn from Ed Norton that you took away? If you, looking back now, such a giant influence to what people do all over the world for their
prize. Two famous people there, Bascom Palmer, kind of crossed an ethical line a bit, and Dr. Norton reeled them in, and in one case a very private way, another case a rather public way, and didn't fire them, but said, I'm going to inject medical ethics and compassion into this creative person's world, and saw all the patients with them. Now, so, I mean, it never occurred.
And saw all the patients with them.
With them.
Wow.
And because he said, I want this creativity to occur, but we got to take care of the patients and do the right thing and tell and be honest with the patients, tell them the real risks, etc. And it was an extraordinary thing. So he truly cared about each and every patient. Resident, didn't matter if they made money, didn't matter if they're a celebrity, cared about all of them. And that, it was instilled in all of us. It was crystal clear that patients come first.
Integrity is destiny.
That's exactly right.
And then
hard work. He would show up at 5:30 in the morning to draw retinas, and then he'd be over at 11 o'clock at night meeting about a new research lab or hiring PhDs in vision science or whatever it might be.
So you did your residency at Bascom. And where did you go then?
Well, at Bascom, something happened that was just purely fortuitous. It was the first residency program to do IOLs, and all the seniors in my group wanted to do them. I said, y'all can have them. And I said, I'll do your vitrectomies and buccals. We hate them. You got it. And then there was the two famous plastics guys and all the skin cancer in Miami. So they, I gave all those away in exchange for doing vitrectomies and buccals. And then they changed from the second year resident to the third year resident doing retina. So I got dual rotations. And then Norton was out with C-spine problem and Gass was on sabbatical. So I did all the faculty buccals by myself. Or with the fellows. And so I got a ton of experience. And then I got in the NIH and built their vitrectomy program. So I didn't actually do a retinal fellowship. So I had 2 years at NIH. I was a fellowship, but I was my own fellowship director.
Fair enough.
And built the vitrectomy program.
Fair enough. What were the vitrectomy instruments you were using?
When I went to NIH, we started with Mockamer's Visc, but I immediately transitioned to the Duvas rotor extractor. And then when I was my first year in practice after 2 years at NEI, a sales rep that detailed a bunch of different stuff for even different specialties, he said, there's this Berkeley machine, the Accutome 800. I said, I know about it. And everybody, all the Mockamer's disciples, if you will, had dissed it. And I said, you know, that is really interesting. Get me one. And so I started being an advocate for the Accutome 800, met Conor O'Malley, started doing Accutome courses, and then when Cooper Vision acquired them, I invented the Accutome 8000. And Conor was very complimentary about it. Instead of feeling like his thunder was stolen, I always gave Conor O'Malley, and rightfully so, a ton of credit. And so that was the first linear suction machine. And the first machine, so we pushed the pedal down farther, more vacuum, which is on every phaco vitrectomy machine in the world. And so it had the first sidekick for turning frag on and off and cutter on and off. And so I invented that. And that's really, then at about the same time frame, I started endophotocoagulation and hand-built the first one. And I also started real-time grayscale B-scan and hand-built the first one.
Besides the vitrectomy machine and the foot pedal and linear suction and endolaser and
real-time grayscale B-scan.
Real-time grayscale B-scan. Was there anything, I mean, those are giant contributions that are pervasive today, but what was your first invention that actually came to?
At NIH, I invented a chin switch that drove the X, Y in the microscope and focus because I wanted to free up a foot so I could have 1 foot for vacuum and 1 foot for another function. And then I invented fluid air exchange and air gas exchange and scissors delamination and forceps membrane peeling and retinectomy.
Yeah. All of that stuff came later, though, but what was
about
first?
About a year later.
What was first?
I guess endophotocoagulation was first.
Wow.
But about the same time, chin switch, and then invented a rack and pinion drive where you held a syringe backwards in your hand where the you know, the Lurlock was at this end, and you could, with your fingertips, run a syringe really nicely. So when we had a roto extractor in one hand, we could drive our own vacuum instead of somebody else doing it.
Isn't that incredible? And so when you left the NIH, where did you go next?
I went to Memphis, Tennessee. There was a guy that I practiced with for a while. It turned out to be a bad actor. But I had high volume. I did 900 vitrectomies the first year.
So let's talk about volume for a second, because I remember some volume firsthand, seeing some of your volume. But let's just talk about, you've been in practice now for 5 decades?
Yes, sir. July 1st will be 50 years.
50 years. How many vitrectomies do you think you've done?
Around 46,000.
46,000 vitrectomies. And that was what, yesterday? So that's pretty impressive. So you moved to Memphis. You went into practice with somebody who broke Norton's rule of integrity.
Yes.
You figured it out. How did you extricate yourself from that?
I left after about 8 years of trying to intervene and be kindly to employees and patients that got screamed at and people that got taken advantage of. And I finally said, I just can't fix this person. I need to get out of here and start over. I didn't have any money. A friend of mine, Charlie Campbell, I said, hey, I met that banker of yours. I got to borrow some money to start a practice. And he said, well, I'll introduce you to my banker. I think you met him on his fishing boat one time. And so it turns out he co-signed my note, Charlie Campbell. I didn't know it.
Wow.
He guaranteed my note.
Wow.
I never knew it until I saw UCC1 at the end of when I put it all back. So I have 4 employees and started practice. And now we have 100 employees, 11 locations, and 11 or 12 doctors.
Wow. Wow.
And I'm not a practice builder by nature. I mean, I'm not an MBA type. I'm not good at coding and billing and reimbursement and all that kind of stuff. It's just I'm focused more on product development and technique.
And quality.
Yeah.
We've had the pleasure of sharing a lot of patients, and yours are always on, which is true. Let's talk about what you feel is the most impactful invention that you brought to the clinic and that has been enduring. And like, I know there's so many of them, not just the ones you listed, but so many handheld instruments, so many techniques, but we'll come to techniques in a minute. Let's talk about devices or instruments. Is it the collaboration with Alcon over the years and these modern vitrectomy sets? Or
sure. The Unity VCS, Alcon's new machine, which was FDA approved in July, I've now been using it for several months, and it'll be launched officially in April. That machine is my fifth generation machine. So first was the Accutome 8000, then the Midlabs. The Midlabs was an important point because that's the first disposable cutter. And then Alcon bought them. Then I didn't like the transaction, how it worked, and because people that are no longer with Alcon. So I started InnoVision in Orange County, not that far from Alcon's R&D facility. And we built what became Acuris and Constellation. It was called the OCM. I actually used it in the operating room and had disposable packs and the whole thing. And that was the first systems integration where illumination and diathermy, servo controlled IOP, actually Freon cooling of the fluids, high-speed cutting, dual actuation, all of that was in the OCM machine. And Rhys Landers used it a bit. Henry Hirschman used it in cataract. And so we had some input from the anterior segment guys. So when Alcon bought that, they didn't like the ergonomics. It had sort of a bigger surgeon interface device on a gooseneck kind of thing. And they didn't like that. They wanted a single sort of kiosk. And so I worked with them to develop Acuris and Constellation. So then it became sort of systems integration and fluidics.
So let's talk about this new Alcon machine for a minute, because people don't always understand the capacity potential of each innovation within each machine. And now you're at generation 5, really generation 8, but generation 5. And it's got a lot of systems integration. It's got a lot of signal processing.
Right.
Lots of code in there, lots of circuit boards in there. Tell us about, first of all, I know you should be rightfully very proud of that collaboration with Alcon and that
34
machine.
Years.
And they are really great at bringing the important things to market. You know, the main thing is keeping the main thing the main thing.
That's right.
So let's talk about this new machine and what you think is really game-changing about it.
The part that I invented, I think, frankly, without bragging too much, is I think the game-changing. The part I specifically invented is the fluidics idea. So I wrote a PowerPoint for the engineering team and the two guys that ultimately got it going. They didn't finish the project up. Others took it over. But I said, no air over fluid infusion, no air over fluid vacuum, no pneumatic cylinders operating pinch valves, rotary valves only, that are high-speed motors directly controlled, and we have to have real-time pressure sensing on the and on both the aspiration and infusion circuits, so it's vacuum sensing on the aspiration circuit. And so we had both pressure, extremely precise pressure and flow sensing on both sides of the circuit.
So dialing down the engineering lingo for a minute, for the general ophthalmologist or the general retina surgeon, what does that translate to in the OR for that?
In the cataract surgeon, it means less capsular ruptures. With the retinal surgeons, I think it'll mean less iatrogenic retinal breaks. There's less pulsatile vacuum. There's 30K cuts per minute. And I've been a major advocate of faster and faster cutting rates over the years, and we've proven that in the lab to be better. You know, it goes so fast, you can't tell it's better in the operating room with respect to the cutting rate. But what you can tell is when you got mobile retina, you can approach a flap of a horseshoe tear and take that flap off, and you're never worried the retina's going to jump in the port and make a tear that's three times as big. When you make a drainage retinotomy, if you want to make one that's 200 microns, you can make a 200 micron one and not gobble up retina around.
And how about for the cataract surgeon?
But the cataract surgeons, it's about you can't collapse the inferior chamber. You're not going to have the iris or the lens diaphragm come forward, and therefore you're going to have less risk of PCR.
And that's a big difference from what they're using now?
For sure. It's way better than the Centurion. Uh-huh. It's much faster response time, and plus it has two resonant frequencies on the phaco, so it literally is twice as fast on the phaco side.
And do you find, and this is something I really don't know the answer to, because of that dual resonance, does it emulsify the lens not just twice as fast, but are there parts of the crystalline structure that are more amenable to different frequencies?
I think we'll find that out. Not being a cataract surgeon, I don't want to opine on that, but my guess is it will be exactly as you say.
That's interesting. Well, given that we're here at the Veil Vitrectomy meeting and you've got your ski clothes on and I've got my beanie on here, tell us a little bit about the history of the Veil Vitrectomy meeting. You're one of the original members. Maybe the last of the original members.
Well, a couple of the rules are, they were made by Mockamer, who was very Germanic and very OCD. You know, we did, if the meeting starts at 6:30, that didn't mean 6:32, it meant 6:30. And invitation only, that makes a difference. B, no pharma. Our meetings are dominated by talks written by statisticians and scientists at pharma companies. Very useful. Pharma's made a dramatic change in our field. I mean, the most important guy in ophthalmology is Napoleon Farrar, and he's a GYN oncologist after all, and that doesn't do medicine. And so pharma's huge, but our meetings are so dominated by pharma, it's nice to have a surgical-only meeting. Invitation only, surgery only, required attendance even to the dinners, so there's a lot of social interaction. But it's not about a social meeting. There are lots of content. It's supposed to be new, and it's a little more subdued in recent years, but you're supposed to have real discussion where people feel comfortable walking to the microphone and challenging the speaker instead of saying, oh, that was a very nice presentation. You know, yeah, great. Well, sometimes you feel that people are completely wrong. Say so.
Right.
Yeah, say so.
Right. Well, I can tell you that having been fortunate enough to be coming here since the 90s, when Veil was already well established, I got shot down and shredded at the podium multiple times, and I felt good about it because I learned so much.
You did.
And everybody was so good to me, and I knew that if I ever gave a talk at Veil, and luckily I haven't, where nobody got their back up, that it either wasn't innovative enough and I wasn't going to get the benefit of the really great interaction.
No, it's critical.
So as you look back on your Veil presentations, does one stand out to you that you remember as being the most controversial? Because the truth is, you'll never say this, but you were right. And when people disagreed, they came to figure that out later. But which one of your Veil presentations really got people pissed off?
I don't know if it's a presentation, but maybe just my commentary from the floor. I've been anti-buckle for a long time. Why? One, the Cochrane Review, numerous papers have shown that it doesn't add anything to vitrectomy. So the opinion that it supports the vitreous base, is that like bee pollen supports your immune system or what? You know, that's the GNC tagline. I don't get it. But let's talk to the anterior segment surgeon. Did they work their tails off to address ocular surface disorder? Yes. Does that occur in buccals? All the time. Did they do a 360 did they open the conjunctiva 360, trap the muscles, and then do poor job of conjunctival closure, so therefore they get an ocular surface disorder? Big time. Did they scrape the epithelium when they do? Big time. Did they get persistent corneal? Big time. What about refractive errors? Our refractive cataract surgeon works so hard to get it right. Then people say, well, I'm a retina surgeon. I just feel better at night if I encircle. So what's the refractive outcome? It sucks. So you have LASIK or PRK, and then a guy encircles you, and now you're -3 or something again? After you, really?
So I remember these battles between you and Buzz Krieger and Jack Coleman, and they were the good old days of Tom Auberg. They were just incredible meetings. And it's picked up a little bit again today, at least this morning. Yeah. It got a little saucy, which was nice. You mentioned something really interesting to me, and I hope to our viewers, which is the relationship between the retina doc and the anterior segment surgeon. And as we democratize care with the instrumentation that you've innovated and make it easier for surgeons to really protect the outcomes of their patients, how do you view the scope of practice of the anterior segment surgeon? You know, we've talked about this a lot, Steve. So should an anterior segment surgeon do a vitrectomy? Should they do a floaterectomy? Should they do, let's start with an easy one before we get controversial. What do you think an anterior segment surgeon should do before they put in a premium IOL?
I think that every single patient, premium IOL or standard IOL, needs to have OCT. I've been an advocate of that for over 10 years. Pre-op, every single one. Because everybody knows about refractive surprises. I had a cataract surgery in both eyes by a very famous guy. I'm on +175 in both eyes. Think refractive surprise. But that's not the whole thing. If you nail the refraction, then the patient has 20/70 vision. Are they happy? They're not happy. And why do they have that? Lamellar macular holes, central serous, with all the steroid use that people have today, whatever it might be, early AMD, an EMM. All these things, when you're trying to do indirect ophthalmoscopy and see those with a cataract and you're a cataract specialist, you're not going to detect those things pre-op.
So early OCT, how about peripheral retinal exam?
That's the other crucial piece. And optos is necessary, but not sufficient. It's very helpful. Problem is that lids and lashes hidden at the 10 to 12 o'clock position, 10 to 1 o'clock position or so, inferiorly.
Look at the fundus with the indirect. I remember presenting the first optos when we developed it. I brought it to Vail and got eviscerated for just that reason. And it's true. It's proved to be right. It was a valid criticism. So let's peripheral retinal exam, macular exam, documented. And
crucial.
And what about for the comprehensive ophthalmologist or the general ophthalmologist who encounters vitreous during the surgery? What do you tell your referring docs
this
to do?
This is something I've worked on for a long time. It's
That's
a pet
why I'm
subject
asking
of mine.
You.
I teach that at Kiowa. I went to every ASCRS meeting, even though I never do cataract surgery. I don't do combined phacovit, for example. And what have I taught? One, never, ever, ever use a cellulose sponge. Because of wicking and because of lifting to cut, it obligatory traction. And people say, well, as long as you get the vitreous out of the way, it'll be okay. No, it's not okay. That's Kasdor's teaching. It's wrong. Intraoperative traction is bad news. Don't pull in the vitreous. So throw your cellulose sponges away. Don't touch the eye with it. At meetings, people will be up giving a lecture. And I said, "Well, I'm using cellulose sponge. Sorry, is Steve in the audience? I'm sorry. I'm sorry about using the cellulose sponge." So I got that message across. Secondly, use the highest possible cutting rate. Thirdly, never withdraw the cutter while you're working. It's like the Doppler effect. You're adding your withdrawal force to when we work our tails off to have a highest possible cutting rate, very low flow rates, and low just barely enough aspiration vacuum in order to get vitreous to enter the port, and then you pull back in the cutter. So don't do this. This is not IA. So vitreous needs to be cut in its original position. Lens material is mobilized to the phacoprobe or the IA in the middle of the capsular bag. It's just just the opposite. So cut vitreous in its original position. Now, what about the pars plana? I teach pars plana vitrectomy, but I say if you're not comfortable, you still got to use two side ports. Infuse in one, aspirate it over here. If you're just not going to learn the pars plana. But if you learn to use the pars plana just for the aspiration side, infused through the side port, that's the best way to do it. And I think they should know that. Now, does that mean that they should go take Asteroid out? Asteroid hardly ever causes visual loss. Do an OCT and you'll see it's really the
magnet. Well, and as Bob Foose showed, patients with Asteroid almost never have a PVD. And so,
good point.
And so when you go to do, first of all, be very careful if you're going to step across into the posterior segment.
No question.
But if you go to the posterior segment, you want to be really certain that you've documented that there's a complete PVD before you get started.
Absolutely correct.
Let's talk about something else that I know you've had strong feelings about before, and that's the iris. So when the iris is playing games with the surgeon, what was your saying? You mess with the iris, it will what?
Well, it's like all sphincters. It gets irritated when you mess with it.
So don't mess with the iris. And that includes, what do you tell your anterior segment colleagues to avoid doing with the iris?
Well, if you got a small pupil, you're going to have to use iris hooks or iris retractor of some type. So you know, you're limited. But just wanton manipulation of the iris is just not a good idea. So do it if you can't properly remove the lens without damaging capsule and encountering anterior vitreous. Then you have to do it. You don't want to gobble up the iris in the cutter. But short of that, don't electively just put hooks in everybody and be cavalier about it.
That's the point I was trying to get from you. Okay, so if we had to talk about a preferred iris retractor, which one would it be?
The Malugin.
Because
Boris invented a terrific machine. It's a great idea.
Because?
Well, it's a little more gentle to the iris because it's more symmetric instead of an iris hook being in particular locations.
Right.
The iris hooks aren't bad. I've certainly used them.
Right. Doesn't require additional
gentle
incisions.
Gentle is good.
Yeah, gentle is good. And another takeaway about the iris is don't retract it if you really don't need to.
Exactly.
Very good. And what about, what do you tell your anterior segment colleagues about fishing out IOLs and dislocated crystalline lenses?
Simplistically, vitreous has to be removed first. Let's say, oh, well, the lens or the IOL will drop down and damage the retina. That never happened in a single patient. If you did a peak at penetrating keratoplasty and you dropped the world's hardest jagged nuclear piece from the moon and it went through there, it'll go, it won't damage the retina. So what damages the retina is doctors, not lens material, not IOLs. So get rid of the vitreous first. When I do, for example, I operate with our superstar anterior segment guy on Tuesday mornings, typically one or two cases, lens floating around the back, the IOL floating around the back of the eye, you know, maybe they had cataract surgery 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and the zonules gave out. And so I use the frag, by the way, with the forceps holding the IOL on one end, and the frag is the best way to get rid of the Summerings ring. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic to get rid of that so there's less bulk that they have to remove. And it's easier to cut it in half and all that and fold it. So at any rate, I get rid of every ounce of vitreous that I can see first before I manhandle the lens at all,
right,
or the lens material.
And how about, what do you tell anterior segment surgeons who want to do it themselves at the time of the case?
Don't.
Exactly. And what about this idea?
Focus on your expertise in wound closure. Focus on your expertise on, does the lens go in the sulcus? Is there enough capsular support? Get the right IOL in there. Think through what's going to happen to anterior chamber depth if you use a three-piece in the ciliary sulcus versus the lens you were intending to use originally. Think through that and get it right.
Let's change the subject just a little bit, but we can go from cataract surgery to small pieces of retained lens fragments, because this will open up a conversation about early intervention. Mm. You've done more puckers, more macular contraction relief surgery than anyone on planet Earth.
I think so.
I think so too. And so let's talk about early intervention or how do you recommend to your anterior segment surgeons to manage retained lens fragments? Do you like it out immediately? Do you believe in this letting it melt away and getting cystoid?
If it's nucleus, particularly if it's sizable, you don't do it on day one. It'd take a few days until the cornea is clear and the pupil will dilate well and the wound's a little more sealed from endothelial cell migration. But, in a week or so, get the nucleus. Now, if it's a little couple flakes of cortex, just watch the patient. Mm-hmm. It isn't operate now or see him never again. It's okay to have him people come back every, even twice a week if you mm-hmm. want, and just see, instead of saying, oh, every piece of lens material is going to cause glaucoma and uveitis, therefore I must do an emergency
and
surgery.
And where do you fall on when do you recommend new cataract guy in town, new person in town, and they meet you and they're, you know, in the presence of greatness and they want to know if I am unlucky enough to have a complication like that, and I think they're going to be okay watching them. Do you want to see that patient anyway to help them, to help support the retina, the anterior segment surgeon?
Always.
Always. So I agree. Always refer if you're the anterior segment surgeon. Your retina doc will protect you.
And the retina doc needs to tell them, this is built into this very delicate procedure. It is not because of your surgeon lack of expertise in any way, shape, or form. It happens to every surgeon, no matter how experienced they are. Always tell them that.
Right, and always send the patient. Always have that good relationship. Let's move over to early intervention for macular disease. Mm-hmm. So I remember one morning, you picked me up at the airport in Tennessee at 5:45 in the morning. My flight from Europe had connected in, and I got in the car, and you said, you know, I just rebuilt this BMW. It goes fast. And you drove me to the office, and I was scared to death, but we made it. And you and Reese Landers were seeing patients, and it was so long ago that you had just closed the first few macular holes. And Reese had
one. About 91.
Yeah, that's exactly when it was. So, yeah. That's exactly when it was, 91. So how many years ago was that? A couple. and you and Reese were talking about early intervention and whether it was better to go in early for macular holes and puckers. Sure. And so share your thoughts on that.
Well, with macular holes, I don't know what you're waiting for because they don't spontaneously close. I mean, even in the trauma cases, some of them, the thought that traumatic macular holes close was mostly a pre-OCT thing mm-hmm. where it looked like a macular hole. It was more like axoplasmic stasis, uh-huh. kind of like a cherry red spot from axoplasmic uh-huh. stasis, not really a hole. So traumatic macular holes very rarely close on their own. So in short, there's no reason to wait. Lamellar macular holes, if they're symptomatic or they're starting to develop schistus surrounding the hole, I go ahead. With lamellar, if they don't have any metamorphopsia and there's no edema or anything around the lamellar macular hole, then I'll follow those. But if they've got VMT, I tend to operate those if they're at all symptomatic or if there's any cystic change. I've never been a Jutrea user, never used it once, wouldn't. With respect to epimacular membranes, the notion that they go see the doctor and they're 20/40, and the conservative surgeon, who maybe doesn't have great hands, he'll say, the vitreoretinal surgeon will say, well, it's just a matter of time until it gets worse and worse and worse. That's not their natural history. The natural history is to develop over a month or two's time, usually a month, and then stabilize. So if they're 20/40 and they're symptomatic, I operate on them. If they're asymptomatic and they're, you know, in a wheelchair, you know, I got a bad eye. You know, okay, watch them. You know, but don't tell them it's only a matter of time till it gets worse. Mm-hmm. Operate now, and you get better results.
And what about for peripheral retinal pathology? So, for example, are you a more aggressive treater of peripheral retinal lesions with a laser, or do you tend to watch them, taking into account that, you know, Norm Beyer, Brad Stransma, Buzz Krieger, I came up in that school, so where do you fall?
Well, Pat Wilkinson's AOS thesis, the late formerly the president of the Academy, was, in my opinion, overly conservative. It was based on surveying, 100 academic retinal surgeons. What was the conclusion? Only treat symptomatic flap tears. I think it's nonsense. I don't think that's the standard of care, and I don't think any of us do that. We treat, it doesn't need to be symptomatic. I've seen patients with four great big horseshoe tears that had a detachment in the other eye, I said, do you have light flashes? No. Do you have floaters? No. Four great big horseshoe tears. I'm going to laser those. And right. Now, I'm never going to do a retinal bubble block. A guy that I compete with in Memphis, now deceased, had two permanent asystoles after doing retinal bubble blocks on every single laser patient. Inexcusable. It's unnecessary. You don't need it. Nobody gets a block. And if patients are nervous, take them to the OR, and they can give a little fentanyl and use the LIO and treat them in the OR. If you have a detachment in one eye and the other eye's got lattice and holes with the holes outside the lattice, you got to treat it, but don't treat them that day. They're already nervous about one eye lost vision. You're going to operate. So at the end of the vitrectomy fixing the first eye, the patient's sedated a little bit, IV's running, they're comfortable on the bed, put the LIO on it, treat the other eye. Works great.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And what about this clinical scenario that we see so often where there's a vitreous hemorrhage and a break? Do you like to operate on those patients, or do you like the hemorrhage to clear and then do a laser, or do you cryo them? How do you handle that? I know it's a spectrum.
If you can for sure see the break, and you can certainly laser it, I have trouble talking the fellows into cryo. They're so good with the LIO. Mm-hmm. You know, they treat the ischemic peripheral retina in babies, so they're really good at that. We manage 6 NICUs, it's a huge NICU ROP practice, and the fellows do that with the attendings. They don't do it on their own, and so they get so good at scleral repression and with the LIO that they'll see a little break. And I said, I can see all the way around. I said, if you can laser 360, let's do it. But I'm not. It doesn't. You know, the only downside in a fake
360 around the break.
Around the break, not 360. Perfect.
Right.
I'm sorry, I didn't say that well. I'm not going to in a fake guy that has 2+ NS. They're going to need cataract surgery anyhow. But what if they have 1+ NS? That's going to progress after vitrectomy. So the only downside of operating on NS nucleus sclerosis patients is the progression is going to be 3 months instead of 3 years. And so it's pretty much inevitable when you got NS, you're going to get cataract surgery someday. And people are getting it at an earlier stage because of, you know,
so you're saying scattering. You're happy to go in early and clear that blood out and get the thing definitively treated. I actually agree with you totally. And I think using the newer platforms, particularly this new platform that you've got coming out, it's much safer,
absolutely,
much more controlled. You don't get the retina jumping into the port.
Coupled with wide-angle visualization and seeing the periphery well, and so you know what you're doing.
Absolutely agree. Now, I'm just going to go back to the Pat Wilkinson comment for those people that are watching. Who was your football coach in high school?
In high school, it was Don James, who then coached for the University of Washington and Huskies and was coach of the year where your son played. But this was many years before your son played there. And then, but when I went to the University of Oklahoma, I was a wide receiver in high school in Miami, but I wasn't anywhere near good enough to play at Oklahoma. It wasn't even a consideration. But I traveled with the team, and I filmed all the ball games, and I got to know Bud Wilkinson. And through him, met his son, Pat, when Bud was running for the U.S.
So Senate. Pat, one of the great vitreoretinal
unsung
giants,
hero.
Unsung heroes, or sung hero in my mind anyway. Yeah. I love Pat and everything that he stood for. And Steve and Pat have disagreed
on that one thing
vociferously, but that doesn't interfere with their great respect for each other. And that's why we're so lucky to be talking to you during Vail, because we want to get those honest disagreements out there, because the truth is it sharpens our field and it makes us better.
Pressure.
No question about it. And, you know, Pat's a hero, you're a hero, and it's just for the audience to know.
Just a quick word about Pat. Yeah. He is the epitome of service above self, because he never played the fame game, he never played the money game, it was never about any of that. It was always the guy that would put the program together, you know, whatever it might
textbook,
be.
Textbook, program, you name it.
So much hard work.
Such a great guy. Such a great, great guy. So let's switch over to training now. You've trained so many surgeons in fellowship and lectured at every residency in the country. Tell us what the 3 top surgical lessons are that you want to impart to your fellows. Distilled, synthetic, high-level lessons that people can take and use in their world. The pearls.
Well, for one is see it well, do it well. I'm a big advocate of ingenuity, and I like that because I got 4.5 times greater depth of field. So I was an early adopter, paid out of my pocket. The surgery center didn't have any money to buy the very first one in the U.S., so I didn't invent it. I don't have a royalty on it. So see it better, do it better. So if the epithelium is cloudy, take it off. I try not to do that. I probably do it once or twice a year. If the lens is cloudy, take it out. You know, you can, you know, don't fumble around in the back of the eye if you can't see what you're doing. If the pupil, if you can't get it dilated pharmacologically, use hooks, even though I'm not a hook advocate in general. So see it better, do it better. It's important. Secondly, it's about thinking through surgical anatomy and really understanding it. All sorts of different parameters on the machine and all that, it's completely unnecessary. if the retina's moving too much, don't push the pedal down so far. You don't need 47 different modes on the machine. In your car, do you have going uphill mode, three fat people in the back seat eating a pizza mode? You know, come on. You know, my ex-mother-in-law's in the trunk. You know, please, please don't do that. And just put the pedal down farther if nothing's happening, and if too much is happening, let up on the pedal. That's important. But then you must slow to press 360, and you must identify any peripheral breaks and treat them with a laser. There's a bit of an obsession with moving every single bit of vitreous. One, you can never do it, and it is unnecessary in epimacular membrane surgery to do peripheral vitreous shaving and remove every last microgram of vitreous.
Still get a good look, and you get your vitrectomy well into
the look is crucial.
Well into the vitreous base. You're
no
just
question.
Not shaving. So I'm going to say, you know, see it well, do it well. Mm-hmm. That's like Krieger's law of get it right the first time.
Yep.
And then there's
scleral depression 360 in every case.
Yeah, that's surgical planning. So Buzz used to always say, yep. The operation starts in the office in your clinical exam, so you can start thinking and planning it.
Just one more piece to that, though.
Yeah,
and
I
that
want to
is
hear that
the vitrectomy is different than the majority of cataract surgery in that it's not a linear algorithm. Being able to think on the fly and switch techniques. I mean, I've, for example, had situations where all three instruments were in one quadrant. We got to the OR, got a little look, said, wait a minute, that choroidal is bigger than I thought. I can't do anything in the nasal side. I'm going to put all my... I've actually held two instruments, one there and one there in one hand, and then held another one there with everything on one side. So be flexible and think through different ways of handling things instead of saying, well, I always do it that way. Well, I got news for you. There's a tremendous variety of pathology. Simple example. You screw up in a patient with pre-op hypotony and infuse into the suprachoroidal space. I've seen famous surgeons, when I was operating at meetings, abandon the patient on the table. Completely inexcusable. Put a needle through the conjunctiva into the subretinal space, into the suprachoroidal space rather, and drain it out and start over and put an infusion cannula on the other side of the eye. Move it over. But figure out a way to save that eye. Don't just hang it up. You ding the lens, take it out.
Yeah,
learn how to do
feet.
A lensectomy.
Right.
You know, well, I can't do a phaco because there's a capsular defect. Well, don't do a phaco. Do a frag. Learn how to use a frag. So you've got to be creative, and so it's a multi-branching algorithm.
Mastery of all the instruments at your disposal.
Exactly, and techniques.
That's great. Let's shift gears again back to invention. You know, when my son Harry, who was in high school at the time, met you, you were one of the inspirations for him to study mechanical engineering.
Oh, great.
And he's gone on to do that. So let's just talk about your engineering career, because most ophthalmologists don't know about it. How many patents do you have?
Over 500.
Over 500 patents. And how many patents in medicine that are not used in ophthalmology, so neurosurge and everything else? Products or patents? Just give us a feeling.
Well, I developed robotic systems for neurosurgery. It was for skull base. My dad died. It was a very terrific guy. He died in my first year in practice of brain tumor on his deathbed, a glioblastoma. On his deathbed, he said, Steve, I want you to take your engineering skills and work with the neurosurgeons and help people like me. So it hit me that we needed basically a microscope for our hands. So I coined the term dexterity enhancement, build robots for the neurosurgery. Stryker bought it. And it was extremely disappointing. Yeah, I got a check, but that's not why I did it. Why is it disappointing? Because all they wanted to do is build a knee robot. And so then they bought another company, Mako, for $1.3 billion and even abandoned what we're doing, which was way better than the Mako robot. So that was very disappointing. So I have a lot of patents on neurosurgery and spine. I've got over 30 with our company, Camflex. And that, we didn't have very good investment banking, certainly not a skill set of mine. So there's a fair amount of neuro and spine and ENT, easily 50, that are not really being utilized, which is disappointing. Because I did it to help the patients.
Well, and I think it did help the patients, even though they may not have used your best way forward. It still was the icebreaker.
And, hopefully.
And I think so. So we've talked about your journey. We've talked about what's important in vitreoretinal surgery. We've talked about how you communicate with the cataract surgeon. If you were to look into the camera at a budding retina surgeon, what's most exciting for you now, and what do you want them to focus on to learn to become a successful VR surgeon?
I think that in America, it's very different than international. Why? Because medical retina is separate in most other countries. So the most famous surgeons, the highest volume surgeons in Italy and some Germany and so on and so forth, don't do any medical retina. So in order to practice efficiently in the United States, unless this changes, you've got to be on top of pharma. How do we differentiate ourselves for comprehensive ophthalmologists? How do we differentiate ourselves from ODs if they get to inject at some point? If you really understand the molecular pathways, you know, Peter Kaiser publishes that thing where that big fold-out map on one side is dry AMD and the other side is wet. There's 40, 50 pathways with different target molecules. You can't learn all of it, but do the best you can. For example, I'll ask anterior segment surgeons, which anti-VEGF you drug? Well, it doesn't matter, they're all the same. Excuse me, you don't know the difference? Lucentis is a fantastic four-week drug, and a biosimilar for Lucentis is going to be a four-week drug. You don't get it that Vabysmo is an 8-week, sometimes 12-week, sometimes longer, 14-week drug? You need to know that. And so you got to learn pharma in order to see the patient. 90% of the patients I see, I'm looking at an OCT and doing an injection. So now on the surgery side, it impacts your time for the operating room to conduct today's vitreoretinal practice with that much medical retina. So you got to work harder to be a good surgeon, and it's split up with so many doctors in these very large practices, run around to satellite clinics doing injections and OCTs. I don't know, I can't earn money in the OR and traction attached to PVR. It's so hard. Somebody's got to operate those cases, even if you don't make a dime. You've got to do it. It's a ditch of responsibility. So you've got to study. So watching other people operate, going to surgical meetings where something other than pharma is discussed, so you somehow maintain your surgery skills.
Where do you see that? So, Steve, we've talked about the past and the present. How about the future? Where do you see us going technologically?
I think that a little bit like automobiles and airplanes, there's some plateauing of vitreoretinal surgical systems and techniques. For example, people love to talk about gene therapy for the biofactory approach. I'm not a fan. I think the RPE has other jobs to do that are very important. You know, Nature's assigned at least 5 important jobs to the RPE.
Probably 50.
Yeah, more like 50. And when you say, by the way, would you please make a aflibercept? Well, it says, yeah, but I can't do any of that other stuff.
And by the way, he's saying that knowing full well that I helped found the first company to create a biofactory for macular degeneration with a virus that makes a aflibercept back there.
So I'm concerned that's not going to be the answer. I've said this not publicly before, but I'll say it. I think that when we talk about the treatment, oh my God, the treatment burden. I'm stunned with, if you talk nicely to the patients and provide a good office experience, with how incredibly the compliant they are. I'm stunned with how the patients actually come in. I've had patients come in and say, I'm sorry I missed my appointment for my injection last week, but my mother died. I said, I'm sorry your mother died. Really? Don't apologize to me. We need to help you. You know. And so at any rate, the drugs that last 47 years after you inject in the eye is overemphasized. AI to interpret images. It's interesting. It's intellectually interesting. It's scientifically interesting. But has anybody demonstrated that we actually have a shortage of image readers? I don't know. And let's say, it's for developing countries. We don't need it in the U.S. Okay. Well, who's going to actually treat the patients that you identified, and where the dollars going to come from to go to rural India or rural China and help people that have DME or AMD?
Well, let's just go to California and rural Tennessee.
Yeah, who's going to do that?
Yeah.
Where's the money come from?
That's right.
And so I'm more concerned about the culture aspects there. Diabetic retinopathy is not going to be the growth that we thought. Why? Because of semaglutide agonists and CGM, continuous glucose monitoring, with all the TV ads for that. Every patient now knows their A1C. People with an eighth grade education know their A1C when they come to my office. 3 years ago, nobody ever heard of it. What's your A1C? What's that? You know. So I don't think that we're going to see a growth. Dry AMD, we don't have an effective treatment. PBM is probably going to be better, I think, than complement inhibition. Complement inhibition is barely helpful, maybe. But to have injections, maybe you're going to live 15 more years. I don't know.
What about on the device side? Anything thrilling you besides the new machine from Alcon?
Oh, besides the new machine?
Yes.
Unfortunately, because intellectual property, I can't detail it, but I'm working a lot on better visualization in the operating room. And that doesn't just mean more pixels. It doesn't mean AI. It means better photonics principles. I have a patent that issued on adaptive optics with time sequential color and polarization control. And I'm working hard on doing a far better job of seeing.
Now I have an important question for you. When was the last time you slept 6 continuous hours?
Oh, when I was a baby.
Yeah. Doesn't sleep.
Every Thursday afternoon now, because I used to operate all day every Tuesday and Thursday. Now with young associates, I have a half day and all day Tuesday and a half day Thursday. I do engineering Thursday afternoon, all day Friday, all day Saturday, every holiday, early in the morning until late in the night. I don't go to vacation. Haven't done that since 96. I don't watch movies. I've never seen one in 30 years. I don't go to concerts, ball games. I study. I started mechanical engineering. Most of it's electronics, and in the recent 5 years, it's more photonics. And so I have my whole apartment's an engineering library. I sit at my laptop 12 hours straight, get up, drink a meal replacement shake for lunch, sit back down, go to work. And so I've taught myself photonics, and so I'm working hard in that space.
All right, let's talk about flying planes. When did you first fly?
I actually didn't fly an airplane until about 1981, 82. I flew my first vacation 3 or 4 years into practice. No sooner did I land, the phone rings in the hotel room. There's a kid with a giant break. I'm sending the King Air to get you, bring you back. So the King Air come pick me up. I sit in the right seat. You want to take the yoke? Sure. So within a week or two or three, whatever it was, Reagan fired all the air traffic controllers, and I was stranded somewhere. Bought a King Air with my ex-medical partner and had professionals fly it. So every time my kids and wife weren't on board, I'd sit up front and they let me fly it. And I said, let's do this right. So now I have an airline transport pilot rating. I'm typed in the 777. I got 6 jet type ratings. I owned a Falcon 50, 3-engine jet. 2 years ago, I couldn't get liability insurance, so I haven't owned a jet for 2 years. But I fly the simulators at FedEx. So I'm flying the 757s, 777, and this coming Thursday, I'm flying the MD-11. Which are, you know, the biggest aircraft in the fleet, and I'm doing that to learn the automation skills and the more advanced machinery, but I got my medical back, and I didn't lose it, but I went ahead and got current on my medical, and I got current on my approaches, so I've been flying with an instructor. I work so hard to get that skill set there. Whether I'll buy another airplane or not, it's a moot point. I don't know.
Right, incredible. So, Steve, on behalf of the field, thank you for everything.
Thank you for asking all these questions.
We're so lucky to have you here. And I'm just going to start end where we started, the point about integrity is destiny. And, you know, it all goes back to our first mentor. I'm sure you feel tingly when you think about Ed Norton. I know I do.
Brad
Strassma, Buzz Krieger. They're just such giants in our lives. And you know, you can't.
Hardest thing I ever did, other than bury my dad, was to give the Norton lecture.
Yeah,
I got all choked up. I couldn't talk for 5 minutes. I stood there and just couldn't talk.
Yeah, I remember Ed and all those guys, just amazing. And one of my regrets was that I never succumbed to the recruitment at Bascom. But I love those guys. And I, going back to Bascom and talking, I remember giving a talk and I was just getting over some viral conjunctivitis. So I was down in that auditorium and I was wearing sunglasses because I didn't want them to think I had red eyes. And Buddy Culbertson said, "What's with the Hollywood sunglasses here?" And I said, "It's making me cry, buddy, to be here." So it's great to be with you here at Vail. You've contributed to so many patients' outcomes and so many through your direct work, and you're really one of the fathers, if not the father, of VR. And so thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
So good to have a friend
so
like
much.
You.
I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. Really great. Thanks very much.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.